Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning we will be taking up a topic that we feature every month here on the program, and that's money management and personal finance. David Sinnoh is here. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I. Once a month, on a Friday, he stops by here and begins by saying a few things on some kind of financial topic, sometimes just talking a little bit about the economy, sometimes something that's very specific to financial planning, and then we go on and answer questions. This time, he has brought with him a special guest, Mark Vonnemay, who is a distinguished clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And the two of them thought that one major subject that we could concentrate on this morning is insurance, which is obviously a very important part of financial planning and something that everybody ought to think about. So I'm sure they'll have a few things to say about that. And if people have questions about insurance, I know they'll do their best to give you an answer. And, of course, more general kinds of questions about investment strategies and money management, the kind of things that we do every month here when Dave is here. I know that they will take their best shot and see if they can help you out. So with that, we'll say to both of you, good morning and welcome to the show. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
And it's, of course, a pleasure to be with you and all of our listeners. I'd like to essentially cover two different topics. First, as promised each month, of course, I want to spend just a brief moment on the couch potato portfolio. And as you just mentioned, we have a special guest with us, Professor Mark Vonnemay, who is a good friend of mine and a colleague in the Department of Finance, also a graduate of the University of Illinois back in my era, David, so a young guy like you probably doesn't remember that. And Professor Vonnemay, when he graduated at the University of Illinois, carved out an amazing career in the insurance industry and became CEO of CNA Surety, which is the largest publicly traded surety company in the United States. And he retired and returned to the University of Illinois to help students learn about the insurance industry and give us the benefit of his experience as well. And we're going to visit in just a moment about insurance issues. And of course, I would urge any of our listeners with questions and issues about insurance, please call in. We'll try to tackle those and do the best we can. Well, as promised, I want to review, of course, the couch potato portfolio. And it's no secret, of course, that the stock market has enjoyed a very nice ride this year, particularly the indexes, which have frankly outperformed most of the active managed mutual funds. We know that the S&P 500, for example, including dividends through yesterday, was up just a little bit more than 16%. So you've got to be very, very happy with that kind of return if indeed you just simply have a diversified portfolio of stocks. So that's a nice benchmark that you can compare your mutual fund against the S&P 500 again if you have large and S&P 500 types of stocks. Well, the couch potato portfolio, of course, consists of approximately 8 different mutual funds, large, small. We've talked about this before. These are index funds. You can purchase them and invest in them through a number of different mutual fund companies. And the couch potato portfolio, including dividends, through yesterday's close, frankly, it even amazed me. It's up 22.46% through January 1 through December 14th. That makes everyone happy, especially my clients, even makes my lovely wife Carol happy. She says, well, it seems like you're doing a good job, but will this continue? What I would like to point out in that couch potato portfolio that we have really had 3 different indexes just dramatically on fire this year. One of them being domestic, and that's the REIT Index, the Real Estate Investment Trust Index. That's up over 35% for the year, and that's on top of double-digit returns that REITs have enjoyed over the last 4 or 5 years. So one of the issues that I've got to look at, I'm going to report back to you on January, is whether I'm going to have any strategic change in my allocation, whether I'm going to cut back a little bit on my REIT allocation because the REITs have performed so far beyond their mean returns that there is going to be some kind of correction. And again, I'm certainly not a market timer, but I could strategically allocate just a bit. I might consider cutting my asset allocation down from 10% in REITs, perhaps to as low as 5 or 6%. Stay tuned. I'll let you know next month on my feelings about that. And of course, I've said we've got to be global investors. We've got to be international investors. The total international index up about 26%. For the year, and even emerging markets, again, up about 26% for the year. So international investing has really paid off this year. It's a great diversifier, of course, to U.S. investing, and has actually outperformed U.S. investors this year on a mean-rated return. So again, the couch potato portfolio up over 22%. It'll be interesting to see where it ends up through the rest of the year. But, you know, it doesn't seem like there's a lot on the horizon over the last 15 days to make a lot of change. But, of course, just the moment I say that, there'll be some major news stories before the end of the year. Okay, so that's what I wanted to talk about in terms of investing. If you've got questions about the stock market, financial advising, planning, et cetera, I'm happy to tackle those. But I really want to spend some time talking with Mark, who really has a tremendous background in the insurance industry. Started out as a student, as I said, at the University of Illinois, well, I guess several decades ago, just like myself, although we're not quite that old. Moved to Chicago, rose through the ranks of CNA, and eventually became the CEO of CNA Surety, which was the largest publicly traded surety company. So you've probably got some good hints for us, Mark. Is there something in just as an insurance brush-up that maybe we all ought to be looking at, or just an overview of what you feel is important?
Well, you know, first of all, I'm very, very happy to be with you today, and I appreciate the invitation. The one thing I think that's important for people to think about, it, and it's one of the things that we talk about frequently as I've come back to campus and started to talk about this idea of risk management for businesses, you know, it's no different for people individually. We have to start thinking more globally, more strategically about everything with regard to wealth management. Now, I've listened to your program before, and I know much of what you talk about is helping people to build wealth. Part of what we have to think about with insurance is it's part of that process. Part of the process of insurance is to help build wealth, and part of it is to help manage that wealth and to retain it over time. And so one of the things that there's lots of information in the news all the time with regard to insurance. We hear about health insurance frequently. We know that there's a large segment of the population that is uninsured. But there are some basic things that we can think about as we start to go through these various stages of life. One of the things that you and I see all the time, we have our own kids that are starting to mature and get out on their own.
No question.
And I think one thing that many times that kids forget about is, gee, I'm going to be out on my own. I have to start thinking about managing my own finances, and not only about the 401k. The easiest thing for them to do as they go in and get their first job is to start get that list of benefits, and they're all excited about this idea that they can finally start to invest a little bit of money, maybe a lot of money. Maybe it's a lot more than they've ever had before. But then they start getting involved and looking at all the other benefits that are available and the need to start stopping and say, well, I don't need this one, I don't need that one, and start to think about strategically a beginning package of insurance products that helps to manage over time. And that starts with some life. It starts with health, obviously. Clearly, they have to think about their own car insurance, probably not through their employer, but they're going to start thinking about that as they get out on their own. And also some property insurance, some basic renter's insurance. And with those four coverages to begin with, and then starting to look at what their employer owns, they can start building a package of insurance to begin this whole process of personal risk management. Now, the important thing for everybody to realize is life changes, and it changes really quickly. And every time we go through one of these stages, we're engaged and we get married, we start to have children. Every time we go through one of these fundamental changes that we go through in our lives, we have to start thinking about insurance as part of that process. So as we start to think about our marriage, we start to probably have to think about, well, I might need a little bit more life insurance. And I have to start thinking about the home that we're buying. And obviously, I'm going to have a homeowner's policy. Maybe thinking about some mortgage life insurance. Different products are available as we all go through these different changes in life. And I think if I can tell people, if I can share one thought with everyone is, it's an ongoing process. It's one of those processes that we have to think about on a regular basis. Sometimes it's hard to do because at times I'm the first to say that sometimes insurance is very difficult to understand. But there are a lot of ways for us to gain knowledge and to think about these things as we go through these various changes in our lives.
Well, let me ask you this, because I have my own two children and I see they're going to be out in the job market working. What about disability for younger people? Is that part of a major thing they should be looking at?
You know what? They absolutely should be looking at it. And I'll never forget when you and I both started out.
Oh, gosh. Don't remind me when we were young.
Yeah. A few years ago. And then I start to realize that particularly as we are offering packages of opportunity for our employees, is every year my CFO and my human resource officer would get together and we start to think about what are we going to offer our employees? And it's very easy to think about the health insurance and life insurance and things like that. But one of the key pieces, particularly as we start to go through these changes in our life, is disability. Now, it's pretty easy for a young person to understand. When you're 18, you're invincible. when you're 22, you're pretty invincible. But as you start to go through these changes in your life, particularly as you start to get married and have children, disability is probably one of the most important coverages I can think about. And so, again, it's one of those pieces that generally it's available. At least some disability will be available through the employer, and then they have to start thinking about whether that's sufficient in terms of covering potential long-term disabilities.
Yeah, what I've seen is that the companies, especially for students graduating from the University of Illinois who are taking positions, that the company offers some type of short-term disability program,
right,
maybe covering their salary for sickness or injury for maybe 30 days, maybe 180 days, maybe even a year, but then one having to step in and buy that long-term disability. And, you know, it's funny. I even think about that myself. I carried long-term disability myself. I have for a number of years. Fortunately, I've never had to delve into it, but I think I agree with you. I think it's a very important coverage. Do we want to take any calls? I see.
Well,
that
we have somebody.
Some calls.
Why don't we do that? I'm sure that we can continue to talk about
Sure.
some of these issues. And if people have specific questions about insurance, give us a call, or other financial planning topics, give us a call. Again, we have here two guests this time around this month, David Sinnoh, who's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business, and he is here to do the show with us every month, and then as a special guest, Mark Vonnemey. He's a distinguished clinical professor of finance also here at the U of I College of Business. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do have someone on the toll-free line here, line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
First of all, I want to reiterate what the speaker said about insurance. My wife and I'm 65. My wife and I have carried disability forever and never used it until 2 years ago. I had retina surgery and was out for 2 months, and all of a sudden we needed that, you know, and really appreciated the fact that it was there.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point, yeah.
My question is not having anything to do with any of the things you are talking about today, but it's about I'm in a profession where I can have a TSA, and I also have an IRA. And is there like a maximum you can put in the TSA?
Typically $15,000 annually, but you're considered an older person.
Yeah.
So you may be able to put an additional $5,000 in, depending upon how much money you make. And you might be able to put in as much as $20,000. There are, in some TSAs, there are additional catch-ups, which might even allow you to put in more than $20,000. The standard rule is 15 plus 5 if you're over 50 years of age. Now, remember, when you put money into a tax-sheltered annuity program, that money is coming directly out of your salary.
Correct.
So you're going to get an immediate reduction in your taxable income for that contribution. Those contributions grow tax-deferred, but Uncle Sam is going to get at them once you start removing them.
Right.
So, and with reference to an IRA, are you talking about a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA?
Well, I have one of each.
Okay. Yeah. Well, currently, probably based upon your income, you would not be eligible for the traditional IRA. For a couple of reasons. One, based upon income, plus the fact that you are participating in employer-sponsored plans. But you may well be eligible for a Roth IRA, and a Roth IRA is strictly dependent upon the amount of income that you earn. For single people, it's $95,000 adjusted for inflation. For married couples, about $150,000 adjusted for inflation. So if you find yourself with more income than that, you probably are not eligible for a Roth IRA.
Okay, I'm nowhere near that. So,
okay.
Yeah, I do have a Roth also.
Okay, good.
And
I urge people with after-tax income to place money into a Roth. It's a wonderful, wonderful idea because all of that money, of course, is growing tax-free as opposed to a tax-deferred environment. And as we both know, you don't even have to take it out. There is no minimum distribution requirement at age 70 and a half.
Right.
So in any event, so how is your health now? Are you back to normal?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm functional.
Okay. Okay. So
my eye is, you know, it's still, they're still not perfect, but I can see and I can work and so forth.
Just one question with regards to your disability. When you filed a claim, did you have any difficulty procuring the monthly income?
None whatsoever.
All right.
And I also was able to receive some from the insurance that my employer provides.
Okay.
So we were in very good shape.
Now, that's very interesting, and that raises another issue, and it's something people should be aware of, that to the extent that your employer pays for the disability and you then receive disability income, that portion is taxable.
Right.
But to the extent that you pay out of your own pocket with after-tax money to pay for a premium and you get some disability, that's not taxable. So I hope you were handling that correctly.
I don't know. My wife is the one that knows about that.
Okay, so you want to check with her on the taxability, depending upon whether it was after-tax money or pre-tax money that you paid that premium with.
David, pursuant to that, is it possible to go back 2 years?
It is. You would have to file an amended tax return.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have a tax professional that you work with?
No, we don't.
Okay, well, it's a little tricky to file those amended returns, but you might be able to do that yourself. You can obviously download them and figure them out, and you could maybe exact a refund then.
Okay. No, see, I'm a minister, and my what we found is that we could never find an accountant that had any idea about all the weird rules that govern pastors.
If you call me off the air at my office, I'll be happy to recommend a local accounting firm that is quite knowledgeable in that area.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
All right, thanks for the call. Others, again, are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think it's a really good thing that you bring up the issue of disability insurance, because I'm sure that a lot of financial planners would say this is one kind of insurance that people don't think about, and that a lot of folks, depending on your age, do you have dependents, that may be a bigger issue for you than life insurance.
Absolutely.
Because there's this very real possibility that something could happen to you, and it could mean that you would be not able to work for some extended period of time. And, you know, heaven forfend, something could happen to you. You could never work again. So it's the kind of thing that you need to think about. Let me shift to the opposite end of the age spectrum and talk about long-term care insurance. I think that it is true that more and more this is going to be, for people who have the means and actually can do it, this is going to be a standard part of financial planning. And it's got to be, because we know just how expensive that can be. If you get to this point where someone has to go into a nursing home, could be in there for a period of years, you can spend their way through everything that person has ever saved. It can bankrupt spouses. You know, it's a bad thing. You don't want that to happen. Can you talk a little bit about long-term care insurance?
Can talk a little bit about it, and it's interesting. It absolutely is one of those pieces that, number one, it's very much in the news, so people are very interested in hearing about it. Mm-hmm. Interestingly, when I was CEO and we were thinking about benefits for our employees, long-term care was one of those at the top. It started to move up to the top of the list. Healthcare was always number one, and then long-term care started to move up, and we did offer long-term care for a period of time. It's one of those policies that, first of all, it's very expensive when you buy it. And I think that's one of the things that turns people off. In terms of the amount of coverage you need, that's difficult to understand as well, and you probably need more rather than less. But I think the average time that I continue to read about is about a 3-year stay that you can expect, about probably 3 years being closer to average in terms of what you might be able to or might expect in terms of the time that you would have in that type of facility. So it is, I know, David, you and I have talked about this before, and it's very complex, however, and so it's very important to get someone who truly understands the policy coverage to talk to an agent that really deals in this type of product, because it's very confusing in terms of exactly what it's going to cover.
And let me just add a couple of things about long-term care and disability. Let's go back to disability. You're 10 times more likely to become disabled during your working career than lose your life. That's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. So disability becomes extremely important, and people will access disability during their working years. A number of them will. With regard to long-term care insurance, you're absolutely right. It's a staggering amount. The problem is it's a middle-class problem. If you're amazingly wealthy, you don't have to worry about this problem, because you can afford round-the-clock care, whether it's in your house or whether it's in a long-term care facility. If you are just poor, which means you really don't have resources, then the state steps in through a Medicaid program and will place an individual in a long-term health care facility. And unfortunately, Medicaid is becoming one of the most rapidly growing expenses, both at the state and the federal government level. It's literally now in the hundreds of billions of dollars of Medicaid expenses each year that is being spent. But if you do choose to buy, and again, this is for a middle-class family, maybe with assets of $250,000 to $750,000, and said, you know, we will wipe out our legacy for our children if we have to go into a nursing home. It would go real fast at $70,000, $80,000, $90,000, $100,000 a year. There's no question about it. Typically, and Mark, you're right, that the average stay in a nursing home is less than 3 years. So what I recommend to people is a policy for no more than 5 years, not a lifetime policy, because that is so much more expensive. You're really bucking the odds if you're buying something with more than a 3 to 5 year life expectancy with one of these policies. You obviously want to buy what's called a tax-qualified program. That is that the premium is a medical expense, and when you receive benefits, there are tax benefits that you receive, and they can be offset against the expenses of the nursing home. And then the waiting period. The longer you have as a waiting period, maybe it's a 180-day wait. So if you go into a nursing home, the nursing home insurance doesn't click in for the first 180 days. The more that you can cover up front, the less expensive that policy is. If a husband and wife are married, obviously the two of them buying it together, it's cheaper than one because of certain discounts that you receive for the two of you. And I think probably you also need an inflation rider, because of the cost of that nursing home is going up tremendously. And then finally, look at your other incomes that you have. And then maybe you don't need a policy that pays $250 a day that will cover your entire nursing home expenses. Maybe you need a policy that's $100 or $125 because you have other income coming in. But, Mark, you're absolutely right. You really need a professional who knows their business in this area.
I think the point that you raise is very. I think too often, and this goes along with much of the insurance that we buy, too often we think that we're going to be able to cover everything, all of our risks with insurance. And that's really, first of all, it would be extremely expensive. And secondly, it's somewhat unrealistic. We have to think about insurance as covering it's a transfer of risk, and we start to think about insurance as one method of managing risk. Part of what we all have to think about, and this goes along with a lot of different insurance coverages, not just on the health side, is we have to realize that one of the things that we have to do is take more responsibility on our own, and that means more monetary responsibility for deductibles, for the fact that we are going to have to save more in terms of handling some of these potential catastrophes down the road. So maybe as we go along, we can talk some more about those types of things, particularly as we think about a strategy for managing risk and using insurance as part of that strategy.
Let's take another caller here. We have someone here in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. This is nothing I'm afraid to do with insurance, but what I'm wondering about is if one were to begin a couch potato portfolio, say with about $100,000, and for maybe a 20-year horizon, how would one, in a period where the stock market is very high, the bond market is very low, what would you do?
Well, it's a great question because my clients ask me this question if they're starting a new portfolio for their children, grandchildren, or for themselves. I tell them the following. I said, number one, let's fund the portfolio with the minimum requirement to meet the index dollar amount. So in the particular indexes that I use, which are 8 indexes, that's $3,000 an index. So basically $24,000 of the $100,000 is immediately invested, and it doesn't matter what the stock market is doing on that given day. Whether it's high, low, or indifferent, it simply doesn't matter. And the moment that you are adopting a 20-year time horizon, you've got time on your side, which is extremely important. And you really need that kind of time horizon. From that point on, I would dollar cost average into my positions. In other words, I would take small increments amount of money each month and add those to the individual index funds. And it might be as small as $200 a month per fund. So we'd be adding about $1,500 a month, which really means that you'd be dollar cost averaging in over 3 or 4 additional years into that portfolio. In the meantime, that money is comfortably ensconced in money funds, which are currently drawing about 5% on an annualized basis. So again, you fund at the minimum level, and then you dollar cost average in, at least over the next 24 months, perhaps as much as 36 or 48. And then you have a nice portfolio working for you, and then you're on automatic pilot. So that's what I would recommend.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Let's talk with someone in Danville. This is line 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. When you were talking about long-term care insurance, I think one aspect that had not been mentioned was how important it is for married people to have this, because if one of the partners needs to go into a nursing home, there are still the home expenses for the other one.
Absolutely.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay, I just wanted to emphasize that.
All right. Now, are you a purchaser of long-term health care insurance?
Yes.
Okay. And both you and your spouse have it?
No, I'm single.
Oh, you're single. Okay. Well, that's very laudable to have it. So that way a loved one already knows that you are taking care of and being responsible for your own health care.
Absolutely. Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Well, now let me ask another basic question, because as Mark, the point Mark made is that these policies are expensive. They will be less expensive the younger you are. The older you are, the longer you wait, the more expensive
right.
it's going to be. So then that comes to the question, well, at what age should a person start thinking about this?
That's hard to say, but I mean, in my mind, the younger it's very difficult to think about these things when you're single. Okay, but as you start to develop, as you start to get married and you start to get into that cycle of your life, again, this is one of those coverages that you want to start thinking about. 30s, certainly in your 30s, it's not too early, in your 40s particularly. But the problem everyone has is how long we're going to be paying this premium, and thinking if I start in my 30s, I may be paying it for 40 years or some long, long period of time. But you have to start. One of the things that I think we all have to do is start to recognize that we're building for the future, and that the earlier we start, as you mentioned, the cheaper it's going to be, or the more cost-effective it's going to be. So earlier is better than later. And it goes that way with life products as well. The same way with life and different product. But we know that when we are in good health, I mean, the important thing is to buy these types of products when we're in good health, not to wait till the point where we absolutely need them. Same way with life insurance and health insurance. We buy products when we're in good health, and it's very cost-effective to begin a process of making the purchase. And I think it goes along the same way with long-term care.
And, Mark, I think you made the very important point, especially with long-term care. When people apply for it, often they can't get it. They're too ill. No one is going to write it. So if you're not taking a lot of pharmaceuticals and you are in good health and you are middle-aged, that's when you can purchase the insurance. But insurance companies are for-profit ventures. They're not in the business of insuring people, where the risks are just tremendous. It's
right.
just not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So, again, I'm not sure 30s and 40s. I've actually been counseling people to look at this in their 50s, mid-50s. It's certainly no later than that. But it's tough to convince people to be thinking about that particular coverage in their 30s and 40s. If they can afford it, by all means. But, again, it's tough. But it's very interesting. People are always happy to insure things. All right? Let's get our car fully insured. Let's get our house fully insured. Let's get our boat fully insured. But when we think about people, ourselves, life coverages, disability coverages, long-term care coverages, for some reason, I'm not clear why, that seems to drop off the radar. That doesn't
seem to be as
important.
Well, I think that's right. And having lived in running a business where our product was required by statute, it's almost too easy at times. When you have to go out and start convincing people about the reasons that it's important, and particularly getting away from the stuff that we purchase or the things that we have that we want to protect, it does become a much more difficult process. I think you're right. I think most people don't start to think about retirement until they're approaching 50. Some people begin if they really are thoughtful, they may start doing it in their 40s, but the earlier the better. And to the extent that we can start making these plans, and just like we do with our own portfolio, start to think about these other aspects of financial planning, the better off we're going to be.
Mark, give me some advice about car insurance, and not so much what insurance I'm going to buy, but at what age should my kids take over their car insurance and other advantages of having it paid for by parents? Are there advantages of having the children have their own insurance, their own car, et cetera? What do you feel about that?
Well, I'll tell you, my experience has been that, and again, these are things that we've talked about. I think I give my children have listened to David Senow and said, I should live with my parents as long as I possibly can. And also, I should take advantage of their financial opportunities as long as I possibly can. And that means car insurance as well. Typically, particularly if the parents have a good auto record, have a good driving record, it's probably going to be more cost effective to keep the kids on their policies, to buy cars jointly, to do the things that to help them manage that expense. Certainly up until the time they're 25. 25 seems to be the magic age when the insurance pricing mechanism starts to come down, where supposedly our children are more mature and they're ready to step out on their own. So that is one piece of advice I can give. I've done that with my own kids, and it seems to work pretty well.
We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me just, for anybody who might have tuned in. Let me introduce again our guests. So we have two this morning, and this is the monthly program we do on personal finance. David Sinnoh is here. He's clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business, and he stops by every month to do this show, always on a Friday, to give people the chance to ask questions about investing, money management. As a special guest, also here in the studio, Mark Vonneme. He is distinguished clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business. And I think that Dave's idea was that one topic we could concentrate on this morning is insurance. But I want to make sure that people who are listening know that you can't ask about something else. It doesn't have to be an insurance question. If you want to do the usual kind of thing that we do when Dave is here, you have other questions about financial planning and money management, you can give us a call. I know that the two of them will do their best to give you an answer. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you another general kind of question, insurance question, because there are, broadly speaking, I guess, if you're interested in life insurance, there are policies that are just pure insurance. They pay a benefit on death. Then there are policies that have some kind of investment component. And I know that people frequently ask questions about that. They say, well, you know, I'm interested in doing some investing and getting some return on my money. What should I, and I'm also interested in having some life insurance. So what do you think about the idea of either having those two things tied together or breaking them apart and saying, investing is one thing, insurance is something else. I don't have to have one thing that does both of those things. And in fact, it might be better if I separated those two things out.
You know, I'll start this, and this is probably one of those things we have talked about from time to time. I'm a big believer. There are ways to put them together, and they can be effective. But if we're going to start with a couch potato strategy for investing, I think that's nicely complemented by insurance that is just that, term insurance or pure insurance products, as opposed to trying to make the combination. Now, for some people, they're totally confused by this whole process of investing. And for them, maybe it does make some sense to think about some of the products that have more of an investment vehicle. But to the extent, I think if you start to manage them, if you want to take responsibility for your own management of your finances, one of the things to do is to separate the insurance from the investment portfolio. And I think over time, I think that strategy probably will pay off.
I couldn't agree with you more. And in fact, there are some tremendously competitive term life insurance products out there currently. It seems to be right. A very competitive business, Mark. I'm not
it
sure
is.
Why, but
it is. And it's almost fascinating because as I go back and I look at this from time to time, you know, by the way, we go online all the time and check, just like other people do. We check pricing. We check what's going on in the insurance industry. And I can't make a recommendation enough for people to go ahead and do that. The funny thing about the internet is, because I think most people still feel that there's enough confusion about it that they still want to deal with an agent or a broker or someone who's a professional in this field, just like they do in other areas. But you know what? There's a tremendous amount of information, including quotes on insurance that you can obtain simply by going to the internet and going to various sites. And doing that, David, you're absolutely correct. You can find some very competitive pricing for term and for other products as well.
Well, let's talk with some other folks here. Urbana is the next in line, line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was wondering what your predictions are for the future of health insurance coverage as a retirement benefit. And in particular, I was wondering specifically related to CSRS, given the fiscal health of the state, dubious or whatever.
That's a tough question. Unquestionably, the trend is that benefits promised by certainly in the private sector employers, that's changing dramatically. That private pension funds have been frozen and employees who are now retired, whose premium was always covered by the employer, that day is slowly over.
And I agree with you 100%. I mean, we saw it in industry over the past. I worked in industry for over 30 years. And so to see the changes that the insurance coverages that were available at the time I started in my career, and at the end, it changed dramatically, David, just as you mentioned. Today, post-retirement health care is probably one of those benefits that if it's not totally gone, it's certainly one of those benefits that employers all of corporate America is looking at very, very seriously to see the cost and benefit relationship.
And you asked a second question, what about CSRS and the financial integrity of CSRS with reference to continuing to pay for the promises that they have made to all their retirement annuitants? Let me make a couple of comments. One is that CSRS, in terms of its investment acumen, has done very, very well. We all know it's a very underfunded system, and it's going to face the same kinds of problems that other public entities face, and that is I'm more concerned, as you have just raised, about the health insurance benefits than actually the pension monthly benefit. The present value of the cost of funding all of the future retirees and the current retirees' health insurance costs is just an astronomical number, and the state of Illinois is going to have to come to grips with that. I can't tell you how it's coming out, but you've raised a huge issue, and as for me, I think that's a more serious issue down the road than whether or not the annuitants are going to receive their monthly benefit.
Well, that's not very reassuring, so to speak. But
I think for people who are currently retired or are soon to be retired, I don't see this as a major problem over the next 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. But certainly 10, 15, 20 years down the road, it is a huge time bomb.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right. We'll go over to a caller in Indiana, in Putnam County, Indiana, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have a question related to health insurance. I wonder if either of the guests are familiar with something called an Association 105 HRA health reimbursement arrangement. It should allow somebody who's self-employed to get a reimbursement through the tax system on some or all of their health insurance premiums and other health costs.
Well, are you talking basically your own private health savings account, your HSA?
Well, no, it hasn't been described to me that way. It's called a health reimbursement arrangement.
Okay, I'm not really familiar with that. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about it.
I think I just told you everything.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with it either.
And do you know the provision of the Internal Revenue Code? It's called maybe it's a Section 105 or something.
Well, it says Association 105.
Okay.
HRA. And they told me which line it applied to on the tax forms, but I don't recall that at the moment.
Gosh. Well, that's very interesting, and I'm going to do some investigating on that, and I'll report back on that next month, because that's something new that I'm just not familiar with. It's really not an area that I spend a lot of time in. But for self-employed people like yourself, this could be very meaningful, I presume.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Let's go on again to then line number two. This is someone in Urbana. Hello.
Interesting about the possibility of rising costs for health care insurance for retirees. I suppose one of the things we can do that we have some control over is to do the best we can to lose weight, stop smoking, all that kind of stuff, so we can decrease our expected need for certain kinds of health care. But the reason I'm calling in is that a number of years ago I worked for a nonprofit organization that didn't pay very much and didn't have a pension, but they did set up a variable tax sheltered annuity that we
right.
could contribute to.
A 403B program.
Yeah. And I'm way past the point where it's been quite a few years since I worked for that organization, and the money's just been sitting there, and I'm reaching retirement age, and I was thinking that maybe I should think about moving this over to Vanguard somehow, but I'm not really sure how generally variable tax-sheltered annuities work on the payout end, and what's your advice on...
My advice would be, so long as you no longer have any kind of surrender charges on that tax-sheltered annuity program, that I would roll that money into my own self-directed IRA program. And that's a tax-deferred rollover exchange. Basically goes from one trustee of a plan to another. But you'd be moving into an IRA program. You could do that at Vanguard. You could do it at Fidelity. You could do it at the local bank. You could do it almost anywhere and then utilize the products and access the products from those various plan sponsors. But that's basically a tax-deferred rollover, and you really don't touch the money. It's going from one trustee to another. And then, obviously, if you're over 59 and a half, you can access the money. Once you are 70 and a half, then you have certain minimum distributions. But I probably would not leave it in my TSA. Typically, those have very high expenses each month that are attributed to them. Even the funds that people invest in, they typically have high expense ratios. So there are probably better uses of the mousetrap, better investments out there.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. That was my sense of what I should be getting my rear end gear to do.
Okay.
Thanks a bunch.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455.
Mark, one other type of insurance that I wanted to talk about is umbrella liability. I counsel my clients always Do we have enough umbrella liability? Maybe you can explain it. And then how much is really enough?
Well, it's one of those, again, it's one of those insurance areas that as you start to develop wealth over time, we can't forget about umbrella liability. And what it really does, it fits on top of some of your other liability coverages. So, for instance, we have an auto policy. We have a homeowner's policy, both of which would have a liability portion. And we want to buy umbrella liability to give some higher limit above that. You know, it's typical as you start to review, and I was checking some of these things out as I was prepping for today's show. You can probably buy $1 to $5 million of additional one umbrella liability. I would say most people probably buy $1 million as a minimum. It certainly would not be unwise to consider, depending upon everyone's individual situation, to consider the possibility of $2 to $3 million as a possibility. But again, it's one of those areas that sometimes we forget about, and particularly as we start to develop a sense of wealth and wealth management, it is one of those areas that will help to protect us. Now, there are some problems with umbrella liability, and that is that we want to make sure that there aren't gaps in the coverage. For instance, you'll probably have a minimum underlying coverage of, say, $300,000 to $500,000 of liability for both your homeowners and your auto, and you want to make sure that they're in line. In other words, that it begins, if it's going to begin with an underlying coverage of $500,000, that we make sure their underlying policies, both homeowners and auto, have the amount of liability coverage to meet that requirement. Otherwise, we could find ourselves with a gap of, say, between $300,000 and $500,000 before the insurance would kick in. Some people may do that as a management tool. Probably not a good thing to do. Probably want to consider, at the very least, consider the fact that we want to have all those gaps filled.
Okay, and you know, one of the interesting things about umbrella liability, again, I'm counseling my clients, anyone is open to lawsuit. Even if there is really no claim against you, one of the things that umbrella liability does is it pays the legal fees.
That's correct.
And that's probably the most important issue and say, wait a second, why am I being sued? I'm not responsible here. I'm not negligent here. But an actual claim has now been filed. It's been brought against you. You are forced to defend it. And the minute you move to court, the minute you hire attorneys, and I'm an attorney myself, it's an extraordinarily expensive business.
Well, it's expensive. It's time-consuming. It's expensive. It can certainly drag on. And I think that's where the umbrella – you're absolutely correct. Umbrella liability has a real spot in the portfolio of risk management for individuals.
Something else I wanted to ask you about, and I find this extraordinarily interesting. I just heard about a week ago. It was reported again in the Wall Street. It's been on CNN. Allstate Insurance pulling out of huge areas of the country on the eastern seaboard under the theory and the notion that these could represent catastrophic areas along the coast. And many, many insurers are simply pulling out of areas where they've had, well, tremendous exposure and huge liability costs from major storms.
Right. Big problem. Big problem. One of the things that we have to do is to recognize that, and you mentioned it earlier, insurance companies are in the business of profitability. And as difficult as it is for them to change that strategy and to pull out of markets, it's one that has to be taken, and they take it very seriously, I know. We have a lot of friends that are in the insurance industry, particularly on the personal line side and the commercial line side. And when you look at as many catastrophes as have happened in the southeastern portion of the United States, particularly over the past few years, it's one of those decisions that they felt that it was appropriate. And it's left a lot of people, and I know you've gone through this. We've had people that have asked us about it before with regard to, well, what do I do? How do I find other companies? And one of the things that we have to realize is that, yes, it's a profit business, but also I believe in the relationship with companies and that it's very easy to go around and shop the best price. Sometimes it's better to find players that are going to stay and they're going to be financially responsible, and that's all part of your choice process in terms of making insurance companies working for you.
Well, you know, one of the things a lot of people over the last 5 years have purchased second homes, and a number of them have purchased them in the southeast or even on the west coast in some of the major areas that are, well, environmentally very enjoyable when the weather is good. And what we've seen, for example, in Florida, and we've seen along the Gulf all the way up through New Orleans, et cetera, we're seeing insurance rates quadrupling,
right,
quintupling. So that what you were paying last year, 2 years ago, you might be paying five times that today, especially if you're on a barrier island or if you're in one of these very, very prestigious areas.
Well, I do. You know, one of the things that goes along with that, David, is the fact that we may have to rethink where we're going to retire. And insurance becomes a big part of that process. A part of what we do is manage our expenses in retirement. And to think about our location, the fact that we may have a couple homes, we may have condominiums in a couple different places as we downsize from that primary residence we have, we have to think about insurance costs. Insurance costs is a real cost today, and it's something that we all have to consider.
Let me ask you just this is also insurance related, a more sort of a basic question, take a step back here, because I'm thinking about life insurance. And for those, if you're at the point in your life where you recognize that this is a need, and say maybe we have a young married couple and they have small kids, and they realize, well, okay, now this is something very important. Something could happen to one or the other. We need to provide for the needs of the surviving spouse. We have kids that someday are going to want to go to college. You know, we have significant financial needs here. How do you decide how much insurance you need?
Very difficult, and there are rules of thumb that I've read. Some say 4 to 5 times your annual income. Some would say 10 times your annual income. Right. But it's individual process too. I think you can look at rules of thumb, and then you have to go through the calculations, start to recognize what your own personal situation is, and then start to make that determination. But it wouldn't be unusual at all for someone to purchase 5 to 10 times their annual income,
or even more if you look at the current interest rates that you can earn on that money, say 5-6% max, 15 times earnings. So if someone is making $50,000, $100,000, multiply that times 15 times and carry that amount of term insurance, because that might start to replace
income. And again, that's one of the pieces we've talked about in terms of starting early. Starting early and make the adjustments in your portfolio as you go forward. You can't afford. It becomes much more affordable when you start to think about those kinds of coverages when you start in your 20s and 30s and then start to look out over the next 25 years or so. The other thing that I think is important is recognizing that as your life changes, as kids grow, your insurance needs change. And so you may not need that forever. You're certainly going to need life insurance throughout your life. And because your stature changes, your asset base changes, you begin to have other issues to think about, estate taxes and otherwise. But those real key earning years and those key years when you have children in the family, have other things to think about, those are very important years to think about significantly more life insurance.
How frequently would you suggest people review their coverage just to ask the basic questions? Do we have enough? Do we have the right kind of insurance? Could we be getting to a point where, as you say, we would recognize in a particular area maybe we actually have more insurance that we need?
Well, I think every time we go through, as we mentioned earlier, we go through these life changes. Okay, we get married, we got out of college, begin a job, we begin a family, we get married, we start a family. Those are obvious points in life where you want to. I will tell you, I think looking at our property insurance, when I start to think about homeowners, every couple of years, there's nothing wrong with looking at your homeowner's policy and say, look, do we really need to adjust the values that we have for our home? And I know that I've done that over the past on a regular basis, if not every year, every couple of years, just to start to see that, make sure that we have the right kind of coverages, and then adding the liabilities would go along as we start to think about, again, accumulation of assets, accumulation of wealth. We want to do this on a regular basis.
And this is where an agent can actually help you, and you can determine whether or not you have a bona fide relationship with an agent at least once a year, sitting down with that agent, or more actively, that the agent calls you. That's a real agent who's calling you and saying, you know, we really ought to reexamine this. We really ought to look at this kind of coverage.
I know we don't have much time left, and we have not really talked about this idea of what the insurance professional is supposed to be. I would give people advice to say, look at your insurance professional, your agent, your broker, as just another one of the team of professionals that you need. You need an accountant, you need an attorney, and you want to make sure you feel comfortable with the insurance professional. Make sure he understands you. Make sure he talks to you on a regular basis. Make sure when you ask him a question, he gives you an answer that makes sense. It seems logical. And those are important pieces I think every individual has to think about as they go through this process of picking insurance.
Well, I'm sure for some people, once they get their policies and it's set up and it's in place, if they're lucky, they don't have to file a claim. Years could go by.
No question.
They don't talk to the person. They don't go down there. And of course, you want that's the way you'd like it to be. You'd like everything to go along fine.
But I think you're right. I think what happens, and that's what makes this process much more important, you need to have a tickler, so to speak, something that gets it out there that's on a regular basis. Because the worst thing in the world is to put these policies in the drawer and not think about them again. And that's one of the most difficult pieces with insurance. We do have to update these and look at them on a regular basis so to make sure that we are covering the risks that we think are appropriate that we have at the time of our lives, particularly as things change.
So I guess the bottom line is everyone should have a New Year's resolution, and that is that if you have not really examined your life insurance, your health insurance coverages, your automobile, the other personal lines insurance coverages that you have, even your business insurance, if you haven't done that in the last 12 months, put it on your New Year's resolution. Make an appointment with the agent now to sit down and have that agent explain exactly what those coverages are and more particularly what they mean.
Absolutely. Very important. Do it as your New Year's resolution.
All right. Well, at that, I guess we pretty much can wrap up for this time around. I want to say thanks very much to David Sinnoh and Mark Vonnemay. Dave is a clinical professor of finance at the U of I in the College of Business. He's here with us every month to do the show. And Mark is distinguished clinical professor of finance in the U of I College of Business, stopping by here as a special guest this month round to talk about insurance. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks very much. And next month, I want to also talk about the inverted yield curve and its impact on recession, on what's looking ahead in the economy. So we'll do that next month.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed being with you today.
Yeah, we appreciate it.